This is an ABC podcast.
A week ago, we were wondering what COP26, the UN climate summit in Glasgow, might deliver for humanity. We'd been told many times that the world was not on track to limit warming to less than 2 degrees, and that Glasgow was our best, if not our last, chance to fix that. Greta Thunberg says the talks have already failed.
This is no longer a climate conference. This is now a global North greenwash festival. A 2-week-long celebration of business as usual and blah, blah, blah.
So is she right? I'm Angela Wipier.
And I'm Stephen Smiley. And today on The Signal, it's the halfway point in COP26. And while world leaders have mostly left, negotiations still have a week to run. So what has the world agreed to so far? And is there still cause for hope in the final week? So, as you may have noticed over the weekend, leaders ranging from the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and the US President Joe Biden to our own Prime Minister Scott Morrison are back on home soil, even though the Glasgow summit is only halfway through. And the talks were deliberately designed to run this way. So to find out why and what they've managed to achieve so far, we looked up Matthew England. He's a professor of climate processes at the University of New South Wales.
Can you give us the basics on how the conference is organised time-wise? Like, what happens week one, what happens week two?
For sure. The time-wise, the process unfolds with week one has had all the world's leaders, or not all of them, but virtually all the world's leaders show up in Glasgow to talk about what their own national commitments are like. And now the hard work of those teams of negotiators from all of the nations across the world, you know, get to work on putting into place, I guess, the pathways toward, reaching those goals that have been set out by each national leader. And so I should say quickly, it's different to past COP meetings that I've been at. In the past, those negotiators would turn up in the first week and then the world leaders would show up in the second week to sort of catch up on where negotiations got to and then make and adjust commitments. And so it's kind of a bit of a different approach this time around. And one of the pleasing things for me was this commitment to net zero that was pretty much pledged by all of the major economies before the meeting even began. But there's disappointing aspects as well that we can talk about.
And just on that sort of almost like front-loaded structure, which is the inverse of what we've seen in the past, whose idea was that and was there any kind of strategic wisdom behind it?
Look, I don't know why it's reversed like this. It does probably go to show that we're at a stage now where all national economies, all national governments are actually, they've got a climate change policy of some sort in place. And so the leadership arriving on the first week and outlining what those policies are is the natural way to go about this, because I read just today that there's going to be 105 different meetings scheduled for this Wednesday. The conference center there has apparently 45 different rooms for meetings to take place. It's a mad flurry now of these negotiations across nations to try to put in place the pledges of their government leadership.
So the headline commitments are what came in the first week, and now in the second week, the task for the representatives still in Glasgow is to hammer out the practical reality of those commitments.
And in terms of those big picture promises, the most far-reaching were that rash of whole-of-economy commitments to phase down carbon emissions to net zero over the coming decades. Australia, the US, the European Union, Japan, South Korea, Brazil, Canada and others say they'll do it by 2050. The aim is 2060 in China, Russia, Indonesia and Saudi Arabia. And as of a week ago, it's 2070 for India, in a major step forward announced at Glasgow. And Matthew thinks this is all quite significant.
All of the big emitters have pledged to net zero pathways, some a bit later than others. So China and India will come in later. They still claim sort of developing nation status. And what that means is their per capita emissions are a lot lower than ours. And so their commitments to net zero are still there, but they're actually going to play catch up, if you like, because their argument is that they're still yet to get anywhere near the per capita emissions of the US and Australia and other countries. So the pledge of net zero is there, and the pathway to get there really is what's being debated now. And what I think we've seen is everything from a commitment to phasing out coal by some nations through to nations like Australia, who are kind of saying, let's just keep on our energy trajectory. As new technologies come on board, we will phase out fossil fuels and move to renewables, but they're not on the front foot. In a way, reading the Australian plan, it's all about responding to international trends. And so they acknowledge that, the Australian government acknowledges, for example, that over the next couple of decades, the global appetite for coal will decline, and that will be why we stop digging it up. It's not the other way around, where we're saying we need a safe climate future for our continent, let's end the extraction of fossil fuels.
So there are kind of two tracks that different countries are on. There's the Australian camp, shared by countries including China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, who all essentially say they will follow the market to get to net zero, but not get ahead of it. And then there's the European camp, who say governments need to do more to hasten the change.
And Matthew says one example of that split that's emerging at Glasgow is on who did and who didn't sign up to a pledge to phase out coal led by the Europeans. It attracted about 40 countries, including some outside the continent like Vietnam and Chile, who all agreed rich countries should quit coal in the 2030s, with poorer ones to follow a decade later.
We've got about 200 nations that we want to sign up to reducing fossil fuels. To have 40 pledged to that is a good start. And I noticed there was a big push for a fund for the South African reliance on coal to be phased out. And that's a good thing to see developed nations helping out some of these nations who are relying on coal to get off that as a power source.
Well, this pledge by the US, the UK, France, Germany and the EU to assist South Africa in its plans to move away from fossil fuel reliance is being seen as the first of its kind, an agreement called the Just Energy Transition Partnership that will see South Africa receive $8.5 billion in loans and grants over the next 5 years to help transition towards a greener economy, in a move that is expected to prevent up to 1.5 gigatons of carbon entering the atmosphere over the next 20 years.
So we need to see those sorts of activities. But in terms of that pledge of 40 nations, you know, we really need to see everybody pledge to this. And the thing that I was really concerned about was to see not just Australia, but also I think India, Russia, the US even not pledging to phase out coal. I mean, it's really the cheapest and easiest way for us to stop our loading of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Now, aside from coal, another of the, you know, kind of big headlines to come out of Glasgow in the week just gone is deforestation. Can you tell us what has been agreed in terms of limiting and trying to reverse deforestation across the world, and how significant this might be in terms of the climate outcomes?
Yeah, no, there's been a big pledge, and this has been much more multilateral. I think around 190 nations signed up to limiting and reversing deforestation. But I do also note that this was pledged back in 2014 by many, you know, virtually the same number of nations. And in some nations, you know, ongoing deforestation has occurred since then. And it's all tied to 2030, so that's only about 9 years away. And so those commitments are important. That the details will be negotiated in the upcoming week. And forests are really important for climate. We need to protect our forests. They do draw down carbon dioxide. And if we see, you know, ongoing forest fires in the Amazon and actual, you know, deforestation, clearing for agriculture and so on, this is disastrous because it takes away a sink of carbon. It takes away one of the parts of the natural system that absorbs carbon dioxide for us, kind of free of charge. So this is a great pledge to see on the table. It's great to see it across so many nations, but it is actually only a small, in terms of the net carbon budget, the forest component, the land uptake component, if you like, of carbon dioxide is not a big part of the overall equation. You know, the biggest anomaly there is our injection of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere when we burn coal, natural gas, oil for motor cars and all these things. So it's good news to see the forest deforestation commitment is a great thing to see signed off by so many nations. We need to see it actually now play out, especially in nations like Brazil that have such huge precious forests. And unfortunately a bit of a bad track record recently of, I mean, the president at the moment is pro, you know, development in the Amazon basin.
Bolsonaro's administration has already overseen historic levels of deforestation, rolling back regulations on protected areas in the Amazon and slashing the budget of Brazil's main environmental agency by 24%.
When you've got a leadership that's pushing for development in this sort of amazing tropical rainforest, that's a concern. But they've signed on to this, so let's see what happens in the next couple of years.
All right, let's turn our attention to everyone's least favourite greenhouse gas, methane. We saw an agreement on this front to reduce methane emissions, and the EU and the US have actually signed on, but Australia has not. What's in this pledge, and why is Australia reluctant to be a part of it?
Yeah, again, I don't know why Australia is reluctant to be part of this. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. The good news with methane is that it has a very short lifetime in the atmosphere compared to carbon dioxide. And what I mean by that is if we were to cease all of our methane emissions today, within 10 or 15 years, we would see benefits in the atmosphere. We'd see those concentrations come right down. It was good to see this pledge. Some of the measures are really easy, like it's stopping leaks from oil refineries and so on. And so this is really easy stuff to do. And it's actually it makes economic sense. It's actually making these refinery plants more efficient by stopping those leaks, and it's better for the environment. The harder stuff like agriculture needs to be addressed too, and there's a lot of different proposals to make some of the beef industry less methane intensive. But I don't know why Australia hasn't signed on. It's a great thing to aspire to. A lot of these commitments are always aspirational, so it does worry me that we're not even signing up to aspirational targets to reduce methane. But it's really a question for the government why they would not commit to this. We've got some brilliant scientists developing, seaweed feed as an alternative to grass. We've got a cattle industry that probably wants to survive and not be phased out. So it's in the beef industry's interest to actually explore these technologies. And like I said, some of the easiest stuff you can do is make these refineries, get rid of all methane leaks out of these refineries, and you can actually start to address that methane reduction anyway before you even get to the harder stuff like agriculture.
Now, you did touch on this before when you mentioned a deal by rich countries to help South Africa decrease its reliance on coal. But more broadly, there is this agreement by 40 countries, this time including Australia, to support kind of technology transfer to developing countries to help them decarbonize. What's in that agreement?
Yeah, I mean, this is really important, and it's very low-hanging fruit, and it's actually really in Australia's economic interest, even if we don't care about greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and we should. But, to transfer technology, nations like India, huge populations, terrible levels of poverty in some of the communities there, and really access to energy has been shown to be one of the great ways to bring communities out of poverty. And so there's some really good things you can do with solar PV, for example. And if you've got a coal-fired power station and you've got to take that energy with poles and wires to remote locations, this is terribly inefficient. Bringing solar PV to these communities can give you local power sources, access to heating, cooking, sanitation improves with access to energy. The climate challenge is incredibly unjust. Some of the nations that have contributed least to the problem are the most vulnerable. So really important to have this pledge. It's a good thing. I'm not surprised the Australian government signed up to it, because it's a massive export opportunity. And it's also importantly, from a UN perspective, at these negotiations, the premise of the negotiations in some ways, and I think it's the right premise, is that our fossil fuel footprint is measured per capita, and Australia's well over 20 tons per annum per person. Nations like India are barely at 2 or 3, I think. China maybe 5 or 6 these days. And so those nations can sort of say, look, our people don't do nearly as much as your people. Why would we do anything to reduce our emissions? We're still a tenth of your emissions per person. And so exporting low carbon technologies to those nations is a really good way to make sure that we keep those carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere to a degree that keeps global warming to safe levels.
And these agreements that we've been talking about, are they aspirational or are they binding? And what do we mean when we talk about those two things?
Yeah, I mean, the Paris Agreement was a legally binding commitment. And so, by the way, way back in 1992, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change specified, this is now 30 years ago next year, that we wouldn't interfere with the climate system in dangerous ways. And we've done anything but that in the last 30 years. We've been pumping huge amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere. So I'm even confused by what does legally binding mean, because it's not like Australia's going to be slapped with a big fine.
So if legally binding doesn't mean a fine or prison time or whatever for national leaders, what is the difference between aspirational and legally binding at this level?
Yeah, I really don't know. I think sometimes nations sign up to legally commit. For example, the Montreal Protocol is the best example of an agreement. And sometimes people say, oh, how can a global agreement change our atmosphere? Well, look at the ozone hole in the 70s. It was going to cause, and it actually did cause, untold damage to Australia's health. You know, I get skin cancers. I've had four of them cut out in my life. And without the Montreal Protocol, we would be in a situation of a very deepened ozone hole. You know, maybe there can be fines placed, because there have been for the Montreal Protocol. But how it plays out with carbon dioxide and the Paris Agreement, I don't really know, because Paris was legally binding, and yet we are going on with business as usual.
Now, going into the COP26 process, we were told that the world was looking at, you know, like 2.7 degrees of warming. We weren't on track for that range that you mentioned was set out in the Paris Agreement. How much confidence do you have now, given what we've seen, that we are correcting course sharply enough to get back into that target?
Not too confident, especially with India, China, the US, Australia, Russia, and a swag of other nations, you know, pledging ongoing burning of coal, and your business as usual is too much front and center. I should point out that 2.7 degrees, you know, that's got a range of uncertainty. It could be much higher than that. And unfortunately, people need to understand the plus side of that. So if it's up over 3.5 or so, then the Greenland ice sheet's gone. And what I mean by that is, with virtual certainty, over the next several hundred years, 7 meters of sea level gets added to our oceans from the ongoing and irreversible melting of the Greenland ice sheet. And a study by CSIRO a couple of years ago shows that Sydney is not viable as a city with over 5 meters of sea level rise. It would need to be totally re-engineered. CBD wouldn't work where it is, sort of thing. And I'm talking about, you know, timescales that a lot of people tune out about. They think, well, this is, you know, beyond our lifetime or our children's lifetimes. But the actual process of getting there is no fun either. You know, the commitments I've seen so far aren't nearly enough to get to 1.5. 1.5 is going to come up in as little as 10 or 15 years. We're already at 1.1 degrees Celsius.
And we're talking there about 2.7, and as you point out, there's a plus and minus associated with that particular figure. That was what we were looking at beforehand. There was an analysis over the weekend by the International Energy Agency that if everybody keeps to their net zero pledges and the methane commitment is delivered, potentially we're looking at 1.8 degrees. I guess all those caveats, all that fine print there, if everyone meets their net zero commitments,
yeah,
that's a pretty big piece of fine print for you.
Yeah, it is. So my response there is, if I look at the Australian plan, for example, for net zero, it's not going to deliver net zero. You can't get net zero if you don't have a clear commitment to phasing out fossil fuels on your radar. And unfortunately, if I look at the Australian plan, there's no fossil fuel reduction in there at all. And that's why when I see these commitments, yes, it's true, if we all meet net zero by 2050, then we'll probably come in under 2 degrees Celsius of warming. My concern is that we won't get to net zero by 2050. The Australian plan won't deliver it.
That is The Signal for today. Our email, if you do want to get in touch, is thesignal@abc.net.au. And we'll be back tomorrow. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.